Welcome to Insights Views Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host for today and sitting in for a regular host, Juanita Watson. I am delighted today to be speaking on the phone with Dr. Barbara Siner. She is the author of a new book, Tales of Addiction and Inspiration for Recovery. This is a book that has a compilation of stories from ordinary people, just like you and me, talking about their own process with addiction or that of a family member. So stay tuned, because today we are really going to get into the emotional aspects of a parent, a mom, as she deals with her own son's addiction. Barbara is a semi-retired psychospiritual therapist and author of 5 books. She maintained a private counseling practice for over 25 years and lives in Northern California. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Irene.
Well, I'm so glad that you are able to join us with your, and we're going to talk about your new book, Tales of Addiction and Inspiration for Recovery. I had the fortunate time of being able to read this book before you actually published it, and I tell you, there's some deep stuff in it, really deep.
I really appreciate you reading it ahead of time and giving me your opinions and your review. It means a lot to me. And, the book is deep. It's been said that it has heart-wrenching stories in it. And I went back and I reread some of the stories again, and some of them are heartfelt to me, and some of them are heart-wrenching. But every one of them is a tale of addiction from just an ordinary person like you and me, no celebrities involved, and I really felt that this was an important work that needed to get out there.
I so agree with you. You know, right now in the news, I mean, there's just so many people, celebrities, you know, people that have big names I know, and in the communities and in the industries and in the world as having addictions, but it's not only them. There's just a lot of us that are just, you know, middle class, ordinary people that have the same issues. And I'm so glad you wrote this book.
Thank you.
Let people know. So there are a number of stories in this book, and how did you manage to get so many people to contribute?
I put out a solicitation, like a call for stories over the Internet, and whenever I did a lecture or a workshop or a class, I handed out flyers with asking if anybody wanted to share an addiction story from any perspective, meaning if they were themselves addicted to drugs and or alcohol, or had a family member or loved one that was addicted, or anybody in recovery that wanted to talk about their story of recovery. And I was just honored with, probably 2 or 3 dozen wonderful stories, and most of them made the book. And how this book came about, let me just start at the beginning a little bit. I'm a counselor for 25, 30 years now, and I started counseling mostly women, but adults that had been abused in childhood, mostly sexually abused. And this was the area of my focus. And through the years, it really became apparent to me how there was such a big connection. I don't know what the percentage is, but a very large connection between adults that were abused sexually in childhood and their abuser either using drugs and or alcohol, or they themselves, the victims, becoming addicted to drugs and or alcohol. And this connection tilted me towards looking a little bit more into the addiction recovery arena at that time. And at the same time, I was going through being a mother of an adult who was an alcoholic. And I had, you know, kind of like between a rock and a hard place. And after reading your book, Rewriting Life's Grip, Irene, I wish I would have had that book about 10 years ago. For you listeners that don't know, Irene has written co-written a wonderful book about transformational recovery for families of loved ones that are addicted to drugs or alcohol. And I found myself as a counselor doing things that I was telling my clients not to do, like don't become an enabler.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And, you know, it's really a hard place to be when you have a loved one that is going through an addiction process and you don't know what to do. You really don't know what to do. You can do all that you think that you should do and some things that you know you shouldn't, but you can't stop yourself from doing. And so I kind of interweave my story and my son's story in this book, as you know.
Yes, I do. And, you know, as a mom, two addicts, and they told me that it's okay to say this. They are in their recovery to a point where it's okay to talk about it. And it's hard. It's hard as a parent because you want them to make their own decisions and to experience whatever they have to experience. And yet as a parent, you don't want them to go through so many pains and trials and tribulations as well. And so it's almost like we ourselves become addicted. It's not possibly to a substance, but addicted to helping them. And I guess that's
true.
All codependency, isn't it?
Exactly. I was just going to say that word.
Yep.
And my mother taught me well how to be codependent. My father was an alcoholic, and she was the biggest codependent that I know of. And that was a learned behavior on my part.
Yeah.
And I went from, you know, one alcoholic to another, trying to help and do the best that I could, and now that I look back on it, of course, overdid, which most of us feel we have done.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't regret anything that I did.
Well, yeah, it's part of the learning process for all of us, isn't it?
Yes,
it
is.
You mentioned just a few seconds ago about imprints. You didn't use the word imprints, but what they are is maybe we can just talk about that to our listening audience and explain that how these patterns are passed down from generation to generation. I'd like you to address that.
Well, I have a favorite story about habits and patterns. Let me tell you it.
Okay.
One day a woman brought her son to receive wise words from Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, about his habit of eating sugar, the little boy's habit of eating sugar. She said, "Gandhiji, will you please tell my son to stop eating sugar? He's a diabetic, and sugar is very bad for him. He won't listen to me, but he might listen to you." Gandhi sat very quietly for a moment and then finally spoke. Although he said nothing about sugar, he simply said, "Will you bring your son back in 1 week?" Well, the mother was puzzled, but said respectfully, "Yes, of course, Gandhiji." When she and her son returned 1 week later, they again stood before Gandhi. This time Gandhi looked directly at the boy and said, "Young man, you must stop eating sugar. It is not good for you, and it is very troubling to your mother when you eat it." The boy said, "Yes, Gandhiji, I will stop." The mother was grateful, but also a little perplexed. "Thank you, Gandhiji, but please tell me, why did you make us come back in 1 week? Why couldn't you just tell my son to stop eating sugar last week?" Gandhi smiled and replied, "Last week I myself was still eating sugar." So, you know, yes, habits go from generation to generation,
yeah.
And we pick up our scripts so easily in childhood, no matter what they are, from eating sugar to not eating sugar, to smoking to not smoking, to drinking to not drinking.
Exactly.
And those people that think that they're above getting some sort of habit need to be awakened to the fact that, say, they go to work the exact same way or they brush their teeth the same way. We're all habitual in our nature, aren't we?
We are, exactly. And
yeah.
The thing is what I found interesting when I started doing a lot of research into this is could be passed down for generations and generations.
Yes.
It's not just passed down from parent to child, but it's like it can go back 10 generations. And if we, you know, really do the study, you will find, and in my, I can say this in my case, that alcoholism, for instance, you know, has been passed down for many generations. It skipped me, but it didn't skip my kids.
Yeah, many times what I saw, too, in the thick of my counseling practice was if there was a strong addictive pattern in a family, the children would either accept that pattern and continue it or completely rebel.
Uh-huh.
In other words, if they had an alcoholic father or mother or both, they would not even taste alcohol at all, or they themselves would succumb to it. So it can go either way.
Exactly.
I'd like to read you, if it's okay at this time, a little bit of the introduction of this book so that your listeners can understand a little bit about why I wrote it.
Yeah, please do.
Okay. Addicted or not, we all have stories to tell. Many recovering drug addicts and alcoholics are asked to write their inventory story while going through rehabilitation programs. These stories are sometimes called drunkalogs or drugalogs. They try to share only to fumble with words that scratch like paper, that scratch paper like chalk on a board from years past. Sometimes words come easy, flowing like a river of grit and filth, covering the pages black. They say only words, words mixed with the flavor of a whiskey sour or the last pin drop of vodka settling in an empty bottle next to a slip of dust. Words of truth swirl downward into a spiral dance with unrecognized poetry left for judgment. With no glimmer of hope to stay straight and sober, inventory stories read like buttons on a shirt, repetitious and dry. But given a year or two of sobriety, and these same words can declare emotions of hope, guilt, remorse, and pain, they become the true stories of an addict's life. To begin writing an addiction story is like poking at a nerve of a hangnail. Clipping it may begin a healing, but you refrain because pain dictates your life. Each paragraph brings that pain to the surface, to be held in awesome awareness as you realize you have lived the words on the pages. It is often suggested to those early sobies that it is, quote, important to reflect and learn why you chose to use or drink. Alas, such a shallow carrot to dangle. The newly sober have only empty words, which spill over onto a blank page. But given 6 months or 6 years, these same words flow easily from mind to pen. They reach deep for shards of memories to fill their stories full of pitiful choices and past sagas of desperation and depression. Words then become a tool to unfolding the corners of life, revealing potent visions and rhythmic tales. Yes, addicted or not, we all have stories to tell. We tell how our skin crawls at the slightest scent of cigarette smoke or our aversions to kissing a drunk. We tell where our choices took us or how our life was lived without us. Whether stories from addicts or straight-chaired grannies, words keep us searching for truth and in the end guide us towards that something more. And this says a little bit about the potency, I think, of the stories in this book. They're not from celebrities, of course.
Uh-huh.
And we see true grit stories just told by people like you and me. And I think the more especially our younger generation can read stories like this, some very hard to read, some very inspirational and successful stories also.
Uh-huh.
And the more that we can get these stories being really open about addiction today, especially to our younger groups, I think the more healing will go on and the more people will seek recovery because they can see the possibility of that.
I so agree with you. And, you know, I was just as I was listening to you and reflecting back on what was going on in my family, and alcoholism wasn't even a word. It was just, oh, they're just a drunk.
Yeah.
And it would be passed by. as just a drunk. And things have so changed. It's okay to say that we're addicted. It's okay to say that we're in recovery. And I'm so glad, because that is just so much healing has been, can occur when we admit and acknowledge.
I totally agree. Uh-huh. I totally agree. I think that it still needs to get out there even more, though.
Of course.
As much as we have shows on TV now, intervention shows and all different kinds of reality shows that really show the truth, our kids are where it has to start.
That's right.
I really feel that our children, as young, you know, as can understand the protectiveness of their bodies and their minds, need to understand not to experiment or just try it, you'll like it type, you know, peer pressure that goes on.
Well, what amazes me is the stories. In fact, I was just at a luncheon last week, and it was a sustainer's luncheon for a recovery center that's here in Austin. And there were several speakers, and it was what amazed me as the majority of them started drinking at like age 14, 13, 12.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, my son did. I didn't know that at the time.
Let's talk about your son.
Find these things out.
Yeah.
Children have done until they get to be older. But
how did you find out?
Well, you know, I knew that he was experimenting when his father and I had separated. And he stayed and lived with his father, and my daughter came and lived with me for a time. And I tried to talk with him. But, you know, when you're young, you think you're infallible and you can do anything. And it was always, you know, don't worry, Mom, and I'm fine, Mom. And and my husband was pretty much in denial about my son's drinking. And so later when he became an adult and said that he started at 14, of course, I was real shocked.
Sure.
His alcoholism progressed into his adulthood and got the better of him and got the better of our lives also.
Are you willing to talk a little bit about how the impact was on you personally?
Well, like I say, it was I was put between a rock and a hard place, being a counselor, working with hundreds of people to try to help them become healthy, and not necessarily in the addiction field, but become healthy on all realms, especially spiritually. And at the same time, I was trying desperately to do what I felt I could do for my son. It was a very hard place for me personally. It was a very difficult place for my husband's and my relationship. We all went through counseling. We went to Al-Anon. Son went through several rehab.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. I'm Juanita Watson, the host of the show, and invite you to join me as I bring to the air both well-known and upcoming writers. You will hear my guests talk candidly about their books, their life experience, specific topics, and the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, my intention is to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are syndicated and archived for availability 24/7 through direct podcast and MP3 download. And as always, I love to hear from listeners. Have a look at our website, InsideScoopLive.com. Send me an email, comment on previous guests, and let me know who you'd like to hear on the show. I'll do my best to bring you your favorite authors live and direct.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. We are speaking today with Dr. Barbara Steiner. Listeners, this is such an important topic. I hope you are enjoying listening to Barbara. She gives us so many areas to consider. Barbara is open to talk about her own experience and the trials and tribulations she went through with her own son succumbing to the disease of addiction. It's not an easy topic to talk about, especially when there's an emotional pain involved.
I don't want to give too much away
no.
in the book, but there is one passage that maybe your listeners would like to hear, which is a little gut-wrenching for me to read, but it's here in the book, and I wrote it, so I'm willing to read it.
Oh, good.
Okay.
Yes, you know, our listeners can relate, I'm sure, to your story, and this is really important for listeners to know that they're not the only ones out there, and so thank you for being able to read this to us.
Oh, you're welcome. This little page or page and a half is about another time that I went to the ER to check on my son. I just left the ER for the umpteenth time. I've lost track of the exact number of visits I have stood over my son's limp body, lying in a hospital bed. As I walked into the room, I tried to intuit a faint aura around his still body to assure me he was alive. My heart broke yet again as I touched his sweaty brow with my cold hands from the winter night's drive. When he felt my hands, he opened his eyes to meet mine. When my eyes met with his sad gaze, we instinctively shared a moment of love, of sadness, and of acknowledgement. He had tubes and electrical leads attached to his body, preventing much movement, but his walnut-colored eyes relayed his story. This time, they said, is the last time. I tried to comfort him in my holistic healing way by holding his feet as they shook unwillingly. I closed my eyes and tried to imagine my divine energy traveling up through his legs and into his still body, praying I was helping him to heal. The doctor arrived and informed me that while it was admirable that Rich had attempted to detox himself off of alcohol, he was at a stage in his years of abuse that could not be stopped cold turkey. This time, Rich needed a medical detox program to alleviate the serious symptoms of withdrawal. He continued to say Rich had experienced withdrawal seizures, and it was too dangerous for him to go through detoxification unsupervised. Rich had learned his own form of detox many years ago, whenever he decided to try yet again to become the sober man he so wished to be. Richard's magic detox regimen had become all too etched in my brain. He would start by making sure he had the necessary items required for several days of isolation while ridding his system of the poison that was consuming his life. He would buy lots of chicken broth, juices, and make sure he had plenty of water available. In addition, he would tell someone, usually me, that he would not be available for a few days. If there were painkillers, Compazine suppositories, Valium, sleeping pills, vitamins, and herbal teas available, all the better. He always assured me he would be fine. I would wait for his call to come check on him. Usually I found him limp in a ball with pans at his bedside filled with vomit. But this time, even with all the right detox stuff, Richard's body could not handle the dangers of withdrawal. Yes, at one point several years ago when trying to detox himself, he experienced paranoid delusions thinking men outside his home were trying to kill him. And another time, he vomited so much his stomach formed bleeding ulcers. But Rich had never experienced seizures while trying to detox that I was aware of. When I left the hospital this time, I felt I had lost a personal battle in being able to help my son overcome his alcohol addiction. After years of struggling to guide Rich towards his light, I felt it was time to tell him I could no longer be the person to watch him slowly kill the life force trying so desperately to live within him. I had made this decision many times, promising myself I would not become one of those clinging mothers, enabling their addicted adult child. I knew this behavior was not healthy for either of us. After all, I'm a counselor, and I knew all the heart-wrenching tales of parents with children that they could not get straight. Yet I found myself becoming one of those parents. I learned quickly when Rich was drinking too much, when he should stop, when to coach him not to drive, when she was detoxing, and rewarded him with hugs and praise when he stayed sober for a few months. I had become that enabling parent, as had my husband. All the past years of living Richard's alcoholic drama rushed through my brain on that cold, dark drive home from the hospital. I did not sleep that night. My blood pressure rose to deadly highs and my gut twisted inside. That night, I detached my enabler self from my being. I needed to go through my own withdrawals of allowing my alcoholic son to walk his chosen journey, wherever that might take him. That was hard to read, Irene.
Oh, thank you for reading that. It was not easy to listen, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Wow. So, I'd like to talk to you about the withdrawal that you had to do and the grieving process that you had to go through in that withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
Would you share just some of your feelings and some of the processes that you went through yourself when the decision you made when you were driving to the hospital?
That was one of the hardest decisions that I've ever had to make. But I had to make it. For many years, I thought that I was making it. You know, it's like in my mind, I was, okay, I'm not going to do that for him anymore. I'm not going to give him money anymore. I'm not going to take him places anymore. I'm not going to fill out forms anymore. I always, all those steps, thought I was calling it quits, but I wasn't. I was continuing doing something until a certain time came, and I share that later in the book, when I said, we're done.
And how did you...
And that had to be a conscious, aware choice on my part.
Not easy.
Oh, it was not easy.
So, what happened? Did you have some, aha moment? Or how did...
Yes.
Yes.
It was an aha moment. And speaking of aha moments, I have to share this. I just read something in... Actually, it was the Oprah magazine... And it went right along so much with what we're talking about.
Uh-huh.
It seems that Gloria Steinem, the renowned feminist from the 70s and 80s, when she was in college, she was taking a geology class, and they were on a field trip. And during the field trip, they were walking around marsh and lakes and banks and so forth, and she came upon a huge tortoise, one of those great big ones, like two or 3 feet in diameter. And it was up on kind of like a dune, really close to a dirt road. And she thought, oh, my God, this tortoise is going to get run over. So she ran over there, and she couldn't lift it, but she pushed and she shoved and directed it down off the dune and pushed it heading towards the lake. And she was standing up and wiping herself off, and her professor came up and said, Gloria, what have you done? And she felt very proud. She stood up, and she said, well, I just saved that tortoise. It was going to probably get run over. It was really close there on that dune close to the road.
Uh-huh.
And he said, Gloria, Gloria, don't you realize it probably took months for that tortoise to make its way out of the water, up the embankment, on top of the dune, in order to find a place suitable to lay its egg? And now you have ruined that whole scenario. And she said right then, she shook her head and she swore to herself that was her aha moment, that it was the last time she ever tried to rescue anything or anyone again.
Wow.
I came to an aha moment where I decided I had to stop trying to rescue. And I think until we come to that point, we are on a long string of I'll stop doing this little thing or that little thing for my loved one that's addicted. And until we come to that hard fact that it has to be a cold turkey you know, we're done. And let that person go on their own journey.
So
that's my story.
That's your story. So I have a question. How did your relationship then change when you made that decision, when you had that aha moment, and it's like, okay, enough of this? What changed between you and your son at that point?
That's a really good question. And trying to think back, since it wasn't that long ago.
What was his reaction?
I would say one of anger. I don't want to say what his feelings were because I don't know all.
How about his actions and reactions?
Yeah, but his actions were of anger.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, how can you do this to me and that
yeah,
type of
blame.
Thing. Yeah, yeah.
And how did you respond?
Weak.
Uh-huh.
Very hard to stand my ground.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Not easy.
Yeah, it's not easy.
You know, we sort of, I think, I'm just reflecting also in my situation, too, that, you know, in my mind, I could just create the scenario and how I'm going to do it, and this is what I'm going to do, and this is what I'm going to say. But when reality really came to play, it was not that easy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a mom, we get really confused within ourselves. Because we're afraid of that loss. At least this is on my part. I was afraid that I was going to lose the kids if I was really just like, okay, this is it. I'm done. As a parent, it must have been really difficult for you to have to handle this.
Definitely. You know, we love our children so much, and we want them to excel and do everything better than we did. And when we have a child that becomes addicted to anything, it's really hard to stand by and watch. So our first instinct is to do all that we can to help. And then there is that point that we come to, if we're lucky, that we have to back off and say, this really is your life and it's your spiritual journey. And living with an addiction is a spiritual journey, I believe. And no one takes that first pill, drink, snort, inhale, injection, or whatever, thinking that they're going to become addicted. But it happens. And we need to do everything we can to help steer them away from that path. And that's exactly what my husband and I tried to do. Have you ever heard of the little story about the autobiography in five short chapters? Actually, you read it in the book.
I read it in the book, but I had heard it before. And in fact, I've got it tagged because I was going to talk about it. So why don't you read it?
It's so good. I'd love your listeners to read it. It's by Portia Nelson. It's called Autobiography in Five Short Chapters. Chapter 1, I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk, and I fall in. I'm lost. I'm helpless. It's not my fault, and it takes me forever to find a way out. Chapter 2, I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I do not see it. I fall in again. I cannot believe I'm in the same place, but it's not my fault. It still takes me a long time to get out. Chapter 3, I walk down the same street, and there's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it. I still fall in. It is a habit, but my eyes are open, and I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out quickly. Chapter 4, I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. And now Chapter 5, I walk down a different street. And that's exactly what I feel like we can do with helping our loved ones.
Yes.
Try to not go through all the ins and outs and helping with getting them out of the hole that they fall in over and over and over again, but steering them towards a different street.
Exactly. And, you know, your book – the book that you had mentioned earlier that I had co-authored, and so many other books and treatment centers and people and movies and, you know, TV shows, and there's just so much out there for help, to help people. And I know that anybody that picks up your book, and I just really, really encourage readers and listeners to do so, because there are some inspirational stories. And I can't imagine that anybody not picking up the book would not parallel to at least one of them.
Thank you. That was this whole idea of writing this book came to me in a dream. And it's very important to me that it gets out to as many people as possible.
Yeah.
It can be a way out, because as we've heard over and over again, until the addict or alcoholic is ready to change their own life, make their own decisions of their own free will, it's not going to happen no matter what we do.
Yeah.
And
the bottom line is us. We're the ones that have to look after ourselves.
Yeah.
And whatever happens to the addict happens, and it may be painful to us, but enabling is just not a healthy way to,
yes,
you know, to around that situation, but we need to really look at ourselves.
Yeah.
And I know that this is something you agree, and the stories in your book certainly aim the readers towards that. So as sort of a wrap-up here, I'm going to give the website address here shortly, but as a wrap-up, do you have some inspirational thoughts to give to our listeners?
I think it would be whatever children are in your care, or whatever children that you can help in getting the word out, that it is so important that they don't just try it. That the kids today are taking prescription pills, and you can get a joint marijuana on any corner. As young as sixth graders are talking about you know, addiction, and it's not too early to start helping the children, and also putting a kind hand out and compassionate heart for anybody going through an addiction. We have to view these people as going through their own spiritual challenge, and whatever we can do to help them. I would say that's my word in my book. Use compassion.
Oh, and that's so important, not only towards them, but towards herself too.
Yes, yes.
That's, you know, we really do need to look after ourselves as well. So, Barbara, what is your website address?
It's my name, Dr. Sinor, drsinor.com.
Uh-huh.
Very easy.
Yes, it sure is. And you also have a blog.
I do, and that's easy too. It's drsinor.blogspot.com. And I try to keep the comments going there on that, and the conversation going about this book and my other books. So come and join me.
Exactly, listeners, join Dr. Barbara Sinor on her blog, on her website, and she has a lot of good information there, and I just really encourage you to check out this book, Tales of Addiction and Inspiration for Recovery. It's a really, really good book. As I say, I've read it myself, and I have to just admit something. It took me a long time to read the manuscript, and Barbara kept asking for me to give my review, but I had a hard time because I would read a story and then I'd have to process. And it's like, oh, man, I thought I dealt with this already, so I'd have to process. Then I'd have to read another book, story, same thing. It took me a long time, but I don't want to discourage the listeners of this because we're all different. But there's just so much importance to this book.
There is. It's not a long book, just over 200 pages, but really has, I hope, every sentence an important meaning.
Exactly, and it does, and I can vouch for that. Thanks again, Barbara. This has been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Arvind.
Talk to you, and listeners, please do check out this book, Tales of Addiction and Inspiration for Recovery by Dr. Barbara Sinor. Bye for now.